So, Karen, we should let everybody know that if they grab this in the RSS feed this morning, they're probably surprised because it looks like we went weekly, but we really didn't.
Right. We did not go weekly. Do not be confused.
Well, but do not be excited because then they're going to expect a show every week. What we wanted to do is we had recorded the show already and we wanted to get it out there for folks because...
Well, we didn't... You know, we know that people take off for Thanksgiving in the United States.
There's this holiday in the United States called Thanksgiving. A lot of people take off earlier in the week. And the key thing I wanted people is a lot of people do travel.
Oh, that's
I wanted
a great
them
idea.
To be able to have this podcast. Because if it
were the plane or the train or the
wherever
bus.
They're going. Right, so if they because the we released it on the Tuesday, they might not have time to get it while they're packing on Tuesday because a lot of people do travel on the Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
So we're giving this a full week early, but you might want to stop it now and save it for when you're traveling for if you're traveling for the holiday in the US. And we'll be back.
And if you are, have a good holiday.
Yeah.
This is episode 1B of the Software Freedom Law Show. I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And this is the Software Freedom Law Show.
See, now we do that.
All right.
See, that's good for people who are new.
It sounds a little hokey, but at least it lets people know who we are.
But that's what they do on NPR. Not that I'm saying we're...
Well, we could strive to be NPR-like.
Yeah, that's my point. That's what I was actually going to say, is that it's not that we can compare ourselves to that level of news reporting, but we can follow the model and try...
Well, right. If they're doing something, it's probably for good reason.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I heard All Things Considered, I thought that it was just... I didn't know radio could be like that. It was pretty amazing.
Hmm.
And so, you're looking at me like I'm crazy just, or something.
Nothing to say to that. It's interesting. I mean, yeah. I think a lot of NPR shows are great. And,
yeah, so...
You know.
NPRI. We should mention PRI just so we don't upset Ira Glass.
I think when he listens to this, he'll be very upset.
I wish Ira Glass. If Ira Glass listened to the podcast that I host, that would be the
co-host.
Most... Co-host. Well, yes, I'm co-host. But the fact that I am a host on a podcast that I'm imagining Ira Glass listening to it, that would be pretty amazing. But I think that will never happen.
I think that's probably right.
You know, Ira Glass and I have something in common. Did you know that?
No, what is it?
We both grew up in Baltimore.
Ah.
And he has a
Baltimore
accent.
You have other things that are in common that you'd have to...
That's probably the main thing.
Okay.
Okay. Just is.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at me like I'm crazy again.
I'm not.
Understand.
And you know, we're very lucky this episode to have another guest.
We're two guests in a row because we went a whole long time with a number of shows.
We had
no
so many things we wanted to talk about.
Yeah, we just couldn't. We wanted to hear ourselves talk so much that we just kept talking and talking for like four episodes straight, something like that.
And now that we're exhausted.
I'm not exhausted.
No, nor I, actually.
Okay, so...
And we had such a good interview the last episode.
We should do a show every day. We're not exhausted.
If we did a show every day and released them at the same schedule, well, I guess, firstly, they'd be very out of date by the time they came out. But we would be... we would not have to record an episode for a very long time.
Okay. So, but we have a guest
okay.
this week.
I'm just kidding. What? We do have a guest this week. It's actually...
This show, we're bi-weekly.
Right. Last episode, you said that we shouldn't refer to this week, and that's absolutely right. But this is actually a follow-up episode.
In a way, yeah. We discussed with... we're going to give away the guest, though. Are we allowed to do that?
We wouldn't be necessarily giving away exactly the guest.
So an episode...
We're allowed to do whatever we want.
Well, I want to follow... you like the suspense rule, and there were many... listeners who felt
or
that
at least
they enjoyed
a few.
The only comments we got were they liked the suspense, so we got no comments.
We're gonna build some serious suspense here.
So in episode 10, we talked to Carlo Piana regarding various issues related to the EU, basically the EU antitrust case regarding Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a lot of interesting things to say about the legal aspects. And if folks missed that episode, it might be worth going to listen to that one first to get some context of the legal side of the EU Microsoft antitrust
case. Do we know
case.
Which show number it was? So let me make it easy for people. Of course, we'll probably link to it. We'll link to it in our show notes.
Yeah, that's right on the same page where they would download this and everything else. So if folks want to get the legal side of it, but today we're going to talk... With a guest who can give us some information.
Who worked with Carlo.
And knows about the more technological and hacker side of the whole issue, as well as lots of other things related to a particular project, which I won't mention because I'll give away.
And he's recently been visible on another organization's webpage.
Well, that's true.
That's another teaser. Well,
I think people figured it out.
I think you can think about that during the musical break.
It's not very long.
Not very long. Better think fast.
And we'll be back with our interview. So, Karen, as we mentioned, we have an excellent guest for this episode.
And our audience has been in suspense since
for all of 5 seconds to find out.
But you couldn't get him, so you ended it with me.
No, we are referring absolutely to you. This is Jeremy Allison, best known as being from the Samba Project.
Hi.
We are going to talk to him today about a number of different things. And the first thing we wanted to ask you about is in a follow-up to an earlier show we did where we talked in episode 10 to Carlo Piana about various things related to the EU antitrust case. He gave us sort of a legal perspective of how all that happened and procedurally how he got it all to work. But what we wanted to hear from you is a little bit about what the outcome of that case yielded for you guys on the technical side of being able to improve and make better the Samba project.
Well, technically, the cooperation has been very good. It actually made a fairly big change, not precisely to the area of the code that I work the most in, which is the file server piece, but for the people who are doing the Active Directory implementation, it's been a great boon for them. And if you get Andrew Tridgell on the podcast at some date, I'm sure he'll tell you a little bit more about it. But Microsoft have been producing lots and lots of documentation. Most of it pretty good, not always 100% accurate, and of course, as always, the devil is in the details. But mostly, it's an excellent guide if you're trying to implement these protocols. And in some ways, we joke that it's kind of taken the fun out of it, because it used to be that you had to have a specific mindset and be a specific kind of engineer to work on these things. And now you can kind of just read the protocol docs and implement from there. So it's, you know, it's not as much fun as it used to be.
Right, because you guys started as primarily basically a network analysis project, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Tridge wrote a wonderful piece with an analogy of creating Samba to trying to order coffee in a French cafe when you didn't speak French, which is it's a really nice piece of text if you want to search for, I think, the French cafe technique.
Yes,
you basically repeat what you hear other people say, and you see what comes back when what the waiters bring you. It's kind of a little like that.
I mean, that type of programming is, for some people, that's really frustrating. Some people are really into it, and some people find that very challenging to have to go through that level of detail, basically, to figure things out.
Yeah, so it's a different... I mean, I'm one of the people who likes banging their heads against a brick wall. So it's, you know, but a lot of programmers who don't like doing that. And so we're actually attracting a different kind of contributor at the moment, because it's a lot easier to actually do some of the contributions. That's not to say, as I said, everything is perfect. The other thing that I must credit Microsoft for doing is they have a help system in place, which is, I mean, they were required to do that as part of the EU deal. Mm-hmm. But the people working those helplines and their email addresses, they're extremely helpful. And they've actually managed to fix some really subtle bugs in Samba and help me track down some problems that we were trying to reproduce with specific versions of Samba with specific versions of Windows.
So can you give a brief example of something specific that's been able to fix?
I wrote a column on it, and it turned out that what I wrote in the column, which was called "Why Writing an SMB File Server Is Still Hard," the explanation that I had in the column was completely wrong.
Well, give our listeners the right one now.
Well, it's fairly technical, Bradley. I don't want to go into the exact details, but it was using one particular version of Service Pack of Windows Vista with one specific version of Microsoft Office when running against the Samba server, and it turned out to be a timestamp resolution problem. Rather than a missing packet issue. But all credit to the Microsoft guys. They actually ran that version of Samba, and they went through and stepped through the Windows code to actually track down what the problem was. And that's actually above and beyond what they were obliged to do legally. So
it must be a weird relationship for you guys now, because after all these years of, as you said, banging your head against the brick wall of their protocols and trying to implement them basically in the dark, now they're basically court required to cooperate with you. How does that feel as a project for you guys? So what do you?
Well, it's kind of nice. It's kind of going back to the way things were before, before about 1995. Five or six, when things got ugly. Before that, we actually collaborated extremely well, and Microsoft, funded Trey. I don't know if you know this. They flew him first class from Australia to Seattle to attend a conference and things like that. And it's kind of going back to a better relationship that we used to have.
That's really interesting. I never knew that, actually, that there was a relationship.
Originally there were some Microsoft developer people that gave us some internal documentation, which is what we based some of this Samba code on, the original Windows NT implementation. And so, it's actually kind of nice. It's interesting. I still kind of enjoy the old-fashioned way of doing things. So the way we're supposed to work is if we find a problem in the documentation, we actually raise something called a CAR, corrective action request, I think, or something like that. And then they have a certain number of days to respond, et cetera, et cetera. And, for some of the things, which is the old file system work, basically the actual sort of what they call SIF, Common Internet File System, that old protocol, there are still so many things in there that are in the document that are they're kind of right, but they're not complete. So Microsoft's put a great deal of effort into making the documents as accurate as possible, but when you're implementing something, the devil is sometime in the details. The arguments that we've had are interesting ones about what level of detail is required. And here's a classic example. So the guys we're talking to are the guys who are actually doing the network protocol, right? So as far as they're concerned, requests to access the file system come in, and they deal with them, they process them, and they're very happy to explain everything that they're doing in that processing layer, and then they pass it down to the file system layer underneath, right, which is NTFS. Now, it turns out that the semantics of that file system and the way it behaves, because it's such a thin layer passing these requests through and these responses back, it turns out that the exact details of what NTFS does with things like file timestamps, etc., they really matter to the protocol, because you have this thin protocol translation layer, and essentially what you're actually seeing is Windows file system semantics exposed on the wire. So, the protocol guys are saying, well, we told you everything we knew. We know about this. And we're saying, well, we see these weird timestamp behaviors. And they're like, well, that's not our department. That's the file system guys, and the file system guys are going, hang on a minute, we're not part of the EU deal. We don't have to document this. This will take us years. The areas that aren't complete yet, and although again Microsoft are working very hard on this, because they finally acknowledge that anything that's visible on the wire that matters, they have to document. It doesn't matter where it actually comes from. So they're actually putting a lot of effort in now to get documents that actually accurately reflect what is visible on the wire, not just what the file system, the file server protocol people think it matters. So it's kind of like the Windows code is, as Scott McNeely once famously described it, this big hairball with everything dependent on everything else. And so, you know, it's hard to pull some of the strings of that hairball without having to unravel large parts of it.
Yeah, it's just amazing and I think that's sort of an outcome of the way Windows is developed inside Microsoft, because everybody has access to everything else, so there's this insular community, whereas in the free software world, obviously everybody does have access to everything else, but they're in different groups and geographically different and so forth, and they have...
And a lot of the time they don't look.
Right, they don't look at the source even though they have it. That's certainly true, but also they have an expectation of other projects obeying certain APIs, and they don't feel like they can reach across API boundaries in the way, I guess, inside Microsoft, I guess they do.
Yeah, I think we depend much more, the free software community depends much more on standards. Mm-hmm. And define standards and APIs. And in Microsoft, you're kind of right. Don't get me wrong. They develop it in a very professional way, you know, with separation between teams, et cetera, et cetera. But it's kind of always easy to say, well, you know, what does it do in that situation? And or even not to actually look, but because the way the thing is designed, you end up introducing dependencies on the underlying system simply because that's all you're ever running on. So to give you an example, the file system semantics that we expose through Samba, we can't depend on anything more than the POSIX standard. So, you know, even if we wanted to sort of make things easy in Samba by just sort of, okay, say, we're remoting the file system onto the wire, like they do, we wouldn't get the same semantics. So we actually have to build that translation layer from the POSIX file system to what the Windows file system does. Whereas in Microsoft, those guys have it a lot easier because all they're basically saying is, oh, this incoming call on the wire is essentially just the same as this internal API call that I make. So they don't actually have to know or care what it is. Thinking about it, it isn't really the fact that they look and they know what happens. It's the fact that they don't look, just like the free software programmers, but they, rather than saying, oh, it should do this, they just call it and say, well, it does what it does. It does whatever it does, and what comes back is what we put out on the wire.
Right, and in our case, you don't only have users who are expecting the Samba semantics or the SMB semantics across Samba. You could have a local user in a shell account is expecting standard POSIX responses,
yeah.
And you have to be right to that user who might be using the thing that's actually mounted as an SMB share.
Yep, that's exactly right. So the interesting thing is that we've found working with them is they've begun to realize how useful having this level of documentation is for themselves, which is great, actually. I mean, that's exactly what we hoped would happen, is that it's kind of like, you know, the realization is, wow, you know, having this level of detailed documentation is actually pretty useful for maintaining the products themselves.
So do you think, there's so much talk about the idea that Microsoft has changed as a company and all this sort of thing. Do you think from your experience in this regard that they have truly changed or what?
Oh no! Sorry.
I was going to ask, and if you felt like this process is helping to bring about some change, but given your answer,
well, it's bringing about change in the engineers. But I mean, their engineers always were pretty friendly anyway. I mean, engineers are engineers the world over, really. Engineers don't like to put things in to prevent interoperability. Engineers just like things to work together. And Microsoft engineers have always been like that, even when they were in their most closed and, you know, if you'll notice in all of the exhibits from all of the lawsuits, it's always the management on top who's telling the engineers, make it harder. You know, the engineers are always the ones who are trying to make things work. You know, I think it's really good for the engineers to have a much more open communication and work with free software programmers in that way. But while the shenanigans around patents are still going on, I don't think that the management of the company has changed. And that's where the change really, you know, if I were to say, wow, Microsoft has changed, they really are a great member of the community now, they would have to stop threatening people over patents. Or as I put it in a comment recently, they would have to stop demanding money with menaces.
Well, let's talk a little about that issue, because rather famously, you resigned from Novell over the Microsoft Novell deal. And I think people newer to the community might not be aware that you had done that. So I think it's worth revisiting that ground, if you could talk briefly about why you did that and why you felt it was necessary to oppose that deal.
Well, sure. I have no objections to a deal with Microsoft that actually satisfies the licensing of free software. So, you know, I'd never wanted to do a deal with Microsoft that basically said, okay, we'll cooperate on some things, you know, that would have been fine. The problem to me was I saw an early version of that deal, and I read it very carefully, and what it appeared to be to me was an attempt to do an end run around Section 7 of the GPL, and we're kind of getting into sort of legal technicalities here.
Oh, our listeners love that, so don't worry.
Oh, okay. Well,
we are,
yeah,
a legal podcast.
Probably much more than me. So Section 7 is basically the all or nothing patent protection, which basically says that this is Section 7 of GPL version 2, that essentially says that if you take a patent license, which means that you could no longer obey the restrictions of the GPL, then you must you are prohibited from redistributing the software that you've created under the GPL. You lose the rights to redistribute under the GPL, basically. And so what they did was they created something they called a covenant not to sue, which to me looked like, you know, sort of the word patent license scribbled over in crayon and, you know, covenant not to sue written in on top. And so I was sent an early copy of it, and, I asked what I thought, and I basically came back and I said to the lawyer, well, tell me why this isn't a GPL Section 7 violation. And the response I got via email was, thank you very much for your input. Please delete all copies of the agreement that you've got. And at that point, I kind of knew it wasn't going to matter what I thought anyway. They were going to go ahead with it. Let's just say I believe that this agreement was added to an agreement that was already being negotiated at the last minute. Let's just put it that way. It was kind of like, oh, we're going to do an agreement, we're going to do an agreement, we're going to do an agreement. Oh, wait a minute, they want this thing as well. You know, oh, and they've given us a week to sign it, kind of thing. Or maybe it was a little longer than that. And so I think what happened was they rushed into something that they hadn't really had time to consider, which, you know, I'm pretty sure was the intention, really. And in the end, I just couldn't live with that.
Yeah, so and this is actually a factor in your guys' decision in Samba to move relatively quickly to GPLv3 when it came out.
Yes, yeah, because GPLv3 prohibits those agreements. It prohibits agreements that were done after a certain date, and the Novell agreement was grandfathered in, I think. I think you guys know a lot more about the decisions on the dates on that than I do.
Right.
So basically I ended up quitting Novell, and, you know, and as my terrible punishment, I had to go and work for Google instead.
So you're one of these special hackers that people are just lining up to hire, I think. So
well, I don't know about that. I mean,
I would be lining up to hire you if I was hiring. I'll put it that way.
Well, I kind of got lucky, put it that way.
Well, that's
so
good.
Yeah,
we're all glad you landed on your feet, and we're also, I think it's really cool. You and I have talked about this. That you guys did switch to V3 and wanted to get the better patent protections that V3 has.
Well, so we've actually talked to Microsoft about this, and they were like, you know, God, you guys made such a fuss over that agreement. I don't know why you were so upset. And the way we tried to explain it to them was this. We said, look, imagine that some company in, I don't know, Romania or whatever, had basically found a way to take Microsoft's Windows EULA, the End User License Agreement, and basically they'd found a legal loophole in it which allowed them to legally resell copies of Windows without giving Microsoft any money in Romania, you know. And we said, well, what would you guys do? Would you go, oh, wow, that was, yeah, you know, we have to hand it to you there. That was a really clever trick you did. Oh, yes, no more money from us from Romania, you know. Or would you say, you bastards, we're going to sue you out of existence, plus we're going to change the EULA to change this term. And, you know, when we kind of explained it like that, they were like, oh, well, yeah, I kind of do see why you went to GPLv3 then. You know?
Yeah, that's...
So I will believe Microsoft has changed when they stop... when they stop doing the patent things, because it's kind of like they've decided that at least at the medium level of the company and lower level of the company, everyone's decided that free software or open source, which they prefer, is a good thing, and they'd like to cooperate and they'd like to use it. But the management of the company are still saying, well, yeah, but only if we control it. And all these patent deals that they do with people are their attempt to put controls over other people's code, which is kind of annoying. And so my feeling is that Microsoft will truly have changed. I've said this to them many times. I said, look, you know, I want you guys to make money off the code.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the way everybody else uses free software, everybody else uses it to make money. I mean, IBM ship free software projects to make money. Oracle ships it. Sun ships it. You know, Google uses free software and ships it. I mean, and you know, there's so much code that's freely available, so long as you're willing to obey the licenses, which are not, I mean, they're really not onerous if you look at most, you know, commercial licensing terms. Sort of having to redistribute your changes is a very, very mild request.
Yeah, we think so too. And that's, you know, sort of the basis for a lot of our enforcement is sort of, you know, the requirements are actually quite easy to, you know, to abide by. And I wanted to ask you actually a little bit about your enforcement along those lines.
Ah, okay. Well, I mean, you guys are the ones who are doing the enforcement for these days.
But there's some old stories there that I think people would love to hear.
It was not always. Yeah, it was not always so. So back in the dim and distant past. So this was our very, very first GPL enforcement. Because we'd adopted the GPL basically because Tridge read it, and that was what Linux was under. And he kind of went, oh, well, yeah, if Linux is under it, then it must be okay. We'll use that. Since then, he's become a lot more sophisticated and knowledgeable about license enforcement. So what happened was, am I able to name names here?
I think that's really up to you, I think.
Great. Thank you. Typical lawyer's answer. Well, how much trouble do you want to get yourself
in? Actually, it's funny because Bradley said a lawyer, and I was saying, well, if you have any doubt, I would recommend not naming names.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
If you're not sure.
So Samba was being, I was employed to do Samba. I was the first person to employ to professionally work on Samba. And we were adding lots of features to it because of that. And we were actually becoming quite popular. And what happened was AN Unix vendor, who I shall not name, they were very interested in using Samba, but the problem was that their lawyers were terrified of the GPL. As you know, people seem to be less so now. Remember, this was GPL v2. I find it really funny now that most corporate lawyers now say, "Oh, we're terrified of GPL v3," but oh, the good old GPL v2. That's the trusted old friend.
Yeah, yeah. Eben actually named this the perfection theory of v2 that would occur at the release of v3.
Yeah, and it's so true. And so I'm talking back about the times when V2 was this terrifying communist document that, you know, was written by Karl Marx and would annihilate corporate life in America completely.
An American cancerous virus that eats up software like a Pac-Man, as I believe.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yes, I couldn't have put it better than Steve Ballmer. They really wanted our code. They really wanted to ship our stuff, but they couldn't face the license. So what happened was someone who shall also not be named saw this as an opportunity. And so what they did was they took the Samba code, they removed all the copyright statements from it, put their own copyright in it, created a binary package, and to add insult to injury, they added a license manager. This is what really
did it.
Did they
use like FlexLM or something, or do they write their own?
Yes. Yeah, no, oh, they were certainly not capable of writing their own. Look, this was a company that, were they not stealing somebody's software, they would have probably been breaking into people's cars and stealing the radio. They were at that level of competence.
So they grabbed Samba code, took the copyright those on, added FlexLM, and then put it for sale? Or
And then they went to this large Unix vendor and said, do we have a product for you? And the large Unix vendor bought it. And they spent a lot of money on this. And so what happened was, of course, eventually it got into the hands of customers. And one of them was also a Samba hacker, and he sent us an email saying, hey, I didn't know you were licensing your stuff under a proprietary license. What gives? And we said, well, we're not. Can you send us a copy of the binary? And I nearly told you who the Unix vendor was then. So let's just say I had very good contacts with the previous with the aforementioned Unix vendor for reasons I won't go into. And so I ran a program called NM, which dumps out the symbols from a binary, and I ran it on the binary that I'd been given, and I ran it on Samba, and they were identical within. I mean, they hadn't even changed any of the function names or anything. It was just a straight, you know. So I sent this comparative output to a bunch of people in the Unix vendor and said, you resold this stuff. What's going on? And at that point, everything went radio silent. and this was hilarious, the company, I think, started claiming that Samba had ripped them off. You know, that we had ripped off their code. And so this was when we first ran into Eben, actually. And so Eben worked for us pro bono, I believe is the term, which is very kind of him. And he flew around the U.S., and ended up talking to these people's lawyers. Now, I think it was he who realized that they were essentially just small-time criminals who had found a scam. And so that was when we actually officially registered Samba's copyright, Samba's code with the Library of Congress. And I think the reason we did that, because you can't sue for damages unless you have registered the copyright.
I'm not a lawyer, but I actually know it's not you can't get damages. The damages are greatly increased that's right. With regard to statutory damages.
Yeah, there are certain rights that you can only enforce once you've actually registered the copyright.
So it's really the damages are much more scary, particularly in the case of as an educational piece for our listeners. A lot of times, showing the direct harm is much more complicated in free software cases, because you give a free license, there's no monetary harm if somebody violates your copyrights, because it's not like you lost money necessarily. Actually, you did in some ways, because you could argue that consulting money and so forth. But the real damages are the statutory damages, which are basically defined by the statute and are doubled, I think.
Right. Yeah, and you can read our Jacobson brief, actually, for some of the discussion about damages in cases of free software. But you actually don't need to register your copyrights to get protection from the Copyright Act and copyright law in the U.S., but you would need to register them before suit if you wanted to...
get those statutory damages doubled, which is really what makes it scary, because they go up so much and people start getting afraid.
I need to check what the damages are.
So, I believe it's doubled.
So once we did that, then they started taking us seriously. It's like, oh, okay. So what they did... So at this point, the Unix vendor basically dropped all contact with them. So they decided to try and sell to the U.S. military instead. And so what they did was they started writing shell script programs that were designed to obfuscate the Samba code. How do we know this? I hear you ask. Well,
I didn't ask that.
Well, you know,
because I actually know.
I said they were incredibly incompetent criminals. And this was back in the very sweet and innocent days of the internet. So they were doing all this work on an NFS server that they had attached to an open internet ISP. So essentially, we were able to anonymously mount their NFS drives and actually watch them develop the obfuscation code in real time, which was kind of fun. And I think at that point, Eben finally went to them and said, we know what you're doing, and this is not gonna wash. And I don't think they ever paid any damages. Basically, they just decided to go away and go and rip off somebody else.
Yeah, but the fact that you guys got it stopped, that's the most important thing, because in some sense, it's people often ask me why I take enforcement so seriously and do enforcement. It's the people, basically that Unix vendor was really getting mistreated in a way, because they could have hired a bunch of Samba hackers at probably half the price and improved the code. They would give you more features for less money and get the code as well.
And in fact, what happened was for the next 5 years, they were scared of using any free software. They were scared away from using free software. I actually tried to go to them at one point and arrange, you know, and try and work collaboratively with them, and they ended up spending, tens of millions of dollars buying a proprietary product to do something similar, simply because they were so frightened by their previous experience because of that. And in fact, that was the precipitation behind the EU lawsuit.
Oh, wow.
when that the proprietary product that they bought, which was actually AT&T's Advanced Server for Unix, when Microsoft pulled the source license to AT&T, and then AT&T could no longer provide this source code to the aforementioned Unix vendor, so it's probably easy for people to guess now. But I'm still not going to say it. So when that happened, that was what when they complained to the EU and that whole thing started.
So it's excellent how that all dovetails into the whole story. I think.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really the other important thing about the enforcement story, and the reason I like it so much is those types of parties who are violating the GPL. They're in competition with people who are complying, because there's people who want to sell services around Samba and sell Samba equipment that has Samba pre-installed and that sort of thing. Those people are often doing it in complete compliance, and they're basically being undercut by the guy who doesn't take compliance seriously. And I always feel like I'm in some ways, even though I'm enforcing on when I do enforcement here at SFLC, I'm enforcing on behalf of the copyright holder, but I'm the champion of the person who obeys the GPL, because that's the person that's getting screwed by the person who's violating it.
Well, the person who's violating is getting a free ride by not having to hire engineers, not having to, you know, not having to go into compliance, not having to, not having to engage at all with the community. They don't have to hire any engineers to do that. You know, now having said that, normally they end up getting out-developed anyway, because doing it that way is dumb. But especially for things like I guess BusyBox and some of the audio and visual stuff, you know, it can be incredibly, if the free software just works, then it can be an incredible advantage.
Oh yeah, and we find that a lot is that they don't modify the free software that much themselves, mm-hmm. because you're absolutely on point about that, because it is so good that for an embedded system you get BusyBox Linux and UC Libc and you're good to go. I mean, you might have to write a driver or two for Linux, but other than that, you've got your new embedded device all ready to go. And so that's a huge benefit that these violators get from the free software community, and they're not required to give back all that much, particularly if they're not modifying it that much. They just have to let people know about the license and give them a copy of the source code more or less as they received it, maybe with a few .config files. You know, it's not that hard.
Yeah, that's what gets me. It's so easy to come into compliance.
It gets me too, trust me. I spend hours and hours every week wondering why I have to tell the same story to the next violator.
That's part of why we published that compliance document that we published, was just to get some of this information out there, to really focus on, it's really easy to comply. Just do it. Then we won't come after you.
You should really translate it into Chinese.
Yeah, we've had this discussion with Harald as well.
Too.
Yeah, I think, Karen, you talked to Harald Valte about that's mm-hmm. the place to go.
Not to be, I'm not trying to be, nationalist or anything, but it's really funny. I was actually in China quite a while ago, and I was at a Linux conference, and I ended up talking to someone there, and said to them, I don't understand why, you know, China doesn't use a lot more Linux. You know, it's great, it's free software, it's, you know, you can check it for any security holes that you might be worried about. You know, Western governments putting in and whatever. And he said, the problem is with Linux is it's too expensive. And I said, what do you mean? I don't get that. It's free software. And he said, no, you don't understand. He said, Windows comes on one blank CD. Linux, and the most popular at the time was Red Hat. He said, you know, Red Hat Linux comes on three blank CDs. It's three times more expensive to burn CDs for Linux than it is to burn copies of Windows. And that's kind of the mentality.
Right. And that's where I think we actually have a connection with that culture, because we actually want people to share free software.
Yeah.
And so the software culture in China specifically, and I think in other parts of Asia as well, is a sharing community. They want to share software with each other. They even share the proprietary stuff they're not supposed to.
Yeah.
And actually the teaching moment there for us to say, hey, our stuff, the free software we've written, we want you to share it. There's a minor thing you've got to do, which ends up actually being relatively minor.
Yeah.
Just make make sure you share the source code too. I guess we do have to handle the cost of the black CDs problem, because there's so much more free software than there is proprietary.
Well, the best thing Microsoft ever did to promote Linux is to add that Windows Genuine Advantage stuff.
Yeah, it's true.
The more they make their stuff harder to copy, the more I cheer.
I've heard that over and over again. The BSA sometimes is the best advocate for free software.
Yeah.
It happened throughout South America. There was so much BSA enforcement in the early 2000s that really pushed lots of South American governments to move to free software, because they just got sick of getting, have the BSA show up at their door all the time, checking what copies of Windows they had.
Yeah, that licensing's expensive, especially because the comparative pricing isn't that different from what people pay in the West. So,
So is there anything else you want to talk about or tout about the Samba project that our listeners might be interested in?
Not legally, really.
anything coming up that you think people should check out or look at?
Well, we finally have a plan for shipping Samba 4, which will have the Active Directory component. And the nice thing is, we're going to end up merging the Samba 3 file server with the Samba 4 Active Directory controller, and we'll just call the whole thing Samba 4 and move on and declare victory. If people here are lawyers from various corporations and are in the storage industry and want to be OEMs of Samba, I would encourage you to contact probably me, actually, because I'm the one who tends to do most of these things. It's funny, sometimes I go to storage conferences and I'll hear presentations by people and occasionally they surprise me by saying, "Oh, and of course the Windows integration is based on Samba." And I was like, "Oh, wow, cool! I didn't know you guys were doing that." And then and then another time they'll talk about Windows integration, and then afterwards I'll go up and talk to them and say, and they'll kind of go, "Well, actually, we're using Samba, but we didn't kind of want to say anything just in case we're doing anything wrong or whatever." And I keep trying to get across to people, and especially the corporate legal types, is we want you to use our stuff. Please use our stuff. This is great. The more you use our stuff and embedded storage devices and whatever, the more we like it. It's not hard to obey the license. We'll fix bugs for you for free, which is which is what I ended up doing to these guys I found recently. And if you actually talk to us, you'll make everybody's product better. So it's actually kind of funny, because we get a lot of mail on the mailing list, and because a lot of people are using Samba in their IT departments, and it's kind of hard to configure, I know, and that sucks, which is why using it in embedded devices really works quite well. And so I'll tell you another funny story about another Unix vendor, and it turned out I saw an email on the mailing list. This was after Vista just came out, and they said Vista doesn't work with this version of Samba. And I kind of read it and I thought, oh, he's an idiot. He's configured it wrong. I know it works with that version of Samba. So I just hit delete. And then a week later, the same message came back. And of course, it was coming from an anonymous email account. So I just kind of ignored it. And then finally, I got an email directly, and it was one of the biggest vendors in the world. And they said, "Help, we're desperate. We bought an OEM Samba from this other company, and they're telling us it won't work with Vista. And we've asked on the mailing list and nobody helped us." and so I kind of said, "Well, that's because you were using an anonymous email account. Nobody knew who you were. If you came out and said, 'We are, an enormous vendor, and we're having problems with our product, which we want to use with Vista and Samba,' the entire team would have jumped on it." And it turned out it was a misconfiguration that they were doing. But it turned out that Vista was tickling a bug in that specific, so Vista worked with Samba in most configurations. With that specific configuration, they were tickling a bug that caused it to fail. And their OEM had told them, their supplier had told them, it can't be fixed. And I fixed it in an afternoon. and at that point, I beat it into them. I said, "No more anonymous email requests. If you want help, post who you are on the mailing list. If you're big, you will get lots of help. I know it's kind of unfair to the little guys who are trying to make stuff work, but to be honest, if we can fix, if we can fix Samba for one of the large vendors of the world, we're fixing thousands more people's problems than if we're doing individual stuff." Yeah. So
Which is actually...
So talk to us. We are friendly.
Which is actually a really good place to end, except that I just wanted to ask you one more thing before we let you go, which is we were just watching the video that you did for the FSF.
Oh, cool, yeah.
So I don't know if you want to plug that.
So they asked me to do a video, basically. The only script they gave me was, I use free software and I support free software. And I thought, well, you know, I want to do a more than a 10-second video. So I put a script together, and this is where I discovered how hard actually doing video work really is. Because I kind of brought in my little... a video camera from home and records to a hard disk and everything. And just doing, because I didn't have time to do a lot of editing. I mean, you know, if we had a full studio, we could have edited it and put takes together. So I had to do the thing in one take.
Oh, wow.
And it's like 3.5 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether you've ever tried to do this, but to try and do a perfect delivery for 3.5 minutes and not screw it up, it's really hard. Even if you wrote the script and you're trying to remember it, just to actually do the delivery without scratching your nose or fluffing a line or saying the wrong thing. People have looked at it and commented and said, wow, you're speaking really slowly. And I always say to them, oh, that's because, you know, I wanted people who, for English is a second language, to understand it, blah, blah, blah. But really, the real reason I'm speaking so slowly is I'm desperately trying to remember the goddamn script.
I love how direct you are and what you're, you know, how you're really giving the message that I think a lot of people who are new to free software need to hear. So I thank you for that.
You can do everything you needed to.
Yeah.
And Jeremy, you've got to admit that you must be pretty darn proud that you have a video being offered on a site right next to a video of Stephen Fry.
I must confess. I was kind of tickled by that. It's like, oh my God, I have a video link that's above the Stephen Fry one. Now, if only I had his agent. And the funny thing was, I had the script. I did this perfect take, and then I realized that I got one of the facts completely wrong.
Oh,
so I had to redo it. So I had to do the whole thing again, but which again took a lot of screaming at the camera. But
yeah.
No, it was fun to do actually. Like I say, I actually did it not for free software users who hopefully already know these things,
mm-hmm.
but for people who might never have come across it before and thought. Yeah, basically the people who think it's shareware.
It's the perfect video to send to people who are confused about free software.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks. That was nice. So, are you guys thinking of doing a video podcast then?
After you just told us all these difficult things about doing video, we've got it down. The audio thing, I can do. This is actually why I didn't do a video for FSF, is because I sort of knew that it's really hard to do video, right? I'm going to stick to audio for now.
I don't know. Bradley, you're very photogenic, and I'm sure the audio-visual production team that you have there at the Software Freedom Law Center would find it easy.
You mean me and Karen plugging things into various laptops to try and get the podcast recorded? That AV team?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, the professional crew. That's right. Yeah.
Well, thank you so
much. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jeremy. This has been really
fun. Oh, it's a lot of fun.
It's been a lot of fun for us, too. Thanks again, and we'll tell people to visit samba.org and learn more about your project and all the great work you guys are doing. Thanks again.
Thanks. It's at www.samba.org. And thanks a lot for having me on the podcast. It's a real honor, because I'm not a lawyer and I don't know much about legal stuff. So I was kind of flattered that you guys asked me to be on it. So,
thanks a lot.
You know, just when I thought I was getting away from this whole, this reputation for being very lawyerly, I'm now going to have to...
Well, but I think I made a really bad misstatement in that. So it's okay for you to correct me.
Well, I wanted us to move on because I didn't want to...
Yeah.
You know, Jeremy is so great. I wanted to let him keep going. But as far as copyright registration is concerned, you do have to register copyright prior to bringing suit. So you don't need to register it before if you don't want to, but before you bring like a legal action in court, you need to actually have a registered. And the statutory damages are not double. They're
This whole double thing, I got in my head somehow.
I wonder
wrong.
If you're getting it confused with the patent willful infringement. That's
triple
damages.
I totally
that's
am.
That's triple. or treble, as they say. Okay. But yeah, that's separate from the copyright stuff.
I retract my earlier statements. What actually happens is you get access to statutory damages because of registration, right?
And actually, only in certain statutory damages, you have to register before the infringement, which in our case is usually
that's important.
Register before suit, and there's ongoing infringement. Then
right, that's
before.
The point to make is that every people a lot of times don't realize this at first, but every act of distribution of a free software program is an infringement if you're doing it out of compliance with the GPL. So. If you distribute it today to someone and then tomorrow to someone, that's two acts of infringement. And oftentimes what happens when somebody first wants to do some enforcement, the first thing we tend to tell them is to register their copyrights. And then if the infringement happens the day after they register their copyrights, then there's a new infringement that is subject to statutory damages and all
that's right.
acts after that.
So in free software, that makes a lot of sense. In other fields, it makes less sense, and you really want to probably... If you think someone's going to infringe, you probably want to register within a few months of your publication. But that's not really the case, because in our world, infringement is ongoing and continuous.
Right. Often ongoing.
Yeah.
Sadly speaking.
Often,
but,
yeah.
But yeah, and I think that the point I made about statutory damages that I think is really important is that actual damages are much more complicated to show in the free software case. I think personally that there are some arguments that there are actual damages from infringement with regard to GPL, because I think people who do consulting work around GPL code bases depend on everyone being in compliance, like I was saying in our conversation with Jeremy. So I think there is some argument for actual damages, but it's much harder to argue. The statutory damages are just so easy to say. You have N acts of infringement, that's N statutory damages, N statutory damages claims. And it can be very, very high, because if there's millions of copies being distributed, that's millions of instances of
infringement. Yeah, really the most powerful tool we have, though, is an injunction, which means that we can use the copyright laws to prevent distributors to prevent infringers from distributing the work. And that's a very powerful tool, because you can shut down someone's business.
Yeah, I used to believe that. I think that we overestimated how important injunction is to us. I think the threat of statutory damages is very important. To be able to say, look, it's going to be really expensive if you want to keep infringing copyrights. Why don't you come into compliance? It's easy, and you won't be subject to
this. I think they're both very powerful tools.
So many tools.
I think, as we say in the Jacobson brief, it's having an injunction tool is essential.
It is an important and essential aspect, but it's only one.
Because the harm can't always be demonstrated as monetary harm.
Indeed. And I agree. But the truth...
Okay, good.
I agree. But the truth of the matter is what's really happening is copyright is so expansive and, frankly, restrictive that there are dozens of tools in the bag because...
Or at least a couple.
Yeah, a couple. There are many, many tools, because copyright is such an expansive thing,
and
which is something we don't generally agree with. But if it's going to be expansive, we want to be able to use it for good as well as the evil that it gets used for by others.
Yeah, I think the moral of the story that you can take away from this podcast, from what Jeremy is saying and what we're saying, is that the GPL is fairly easy to comply with.
Yeah.
If you comply, you know, you don't have to worry about copyright enforcement.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I agree.
That's my fortune. That's too long for a fortune cookie.
I agree. And the other thing they can take away is that when I start talking to Jeremy, I get so excited that I'm talking to Jeremy and it's so much fun that I say things that are like totally wrong, which is the other lesson we've learned. So I'm glad that we realized that quickly enough to correct it in the same show.
He's very entertaining and engaging.
But yeah, I agree. I think he's a lot of fun. As you know, I had an opportunity to perform on stage with Jeremy when he did his big quiz bowl thing.
That was pretty fun.
I really enjoyed being a judge on the quiz bowl as he imitated Steve Ballmer, which there are videos online of that, folks, if people want to find it. I'm not going to promise to put in the show notes, because I think they're hard to find and they might be in proprietary format.
Yeah, I bet
really
they are.
Sad. So yeah. I'm not going to link to anything that's in proprietary format. So actually, if it's in a proprietary format, Just wait and ask Jeremy to perform it for you in live next time, rather than download some proprietary stuff.
All right.
Okay, we'll see you. It's actually going to be because we're gonna, as we mentioned in the beginning, we're doing this, releasing the show a little bit early, so it'll actually be 3 weeks before the next show. So
we may not have mentioned it in the beginning. I'm not sure.
Yes, we do. I'm sure.
All right. We'll see you next time.
Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
Okay, this is becoming a habit. We didn't record a funny thing again. I don't know what to say. I'm all alone.